Hi, and welcome to the Cloud Computing Show, episode number 28. It's roundtable day today, and I'm really happy to welcome the crew here. First, we've got James Waters, Senior Manager of vCloud Solutions at VMware. Hey, James.
Hey, Gary.
And Adrian Cole, the founder of JClouds. Hey, Adrian.
Hola.
And joining us for the first time, but hopefully not the last, Wes Berry, who is from EngineYard and also the founder of Fog. Hey, Wes.
Hey, Gary.
Great to have everybody here. This is Gary Orenstein. I'm the host of the Cloud Computing Show. And we'll jump right into the industry news. A few weeks ago, we had the acquisition of RabbitMQ by SpringSource, which is in turn owned by VMware. And pretty big item for cloud computing and messaging space. Who wants to go first with a little opinion on that?
Well, RabbitMQ is embedded in a lot of more modern cloud architectures. And if you look at a lot of what people have been complaining about with RESTful or cloud APIs, a lot of it had to do with asynchronicity. And, you know, one of the things that you end up dealing with a cloud architecture is passing data in and out from your site in a safe way to get to wherever your cloud site is or back. And I think a lot of these places and more often looking for standard solutions like AMQP, that the RabbitMQ is going to end up popping up much more often.
Was that an open source project as well?
Yeah, open source.
So this sort of fits into that whole theme of the VMware theme of aggregating some of these tools. Certainly, SpringSource similarly focused on developers.
Yeah, it also follows a trend of sorts. I mean, with Redis, founder working for VMware too. These are tools that have a wide adoption, across communities, Ruby communities, Java communities, etc. And so I think they're really just kind of producing a better developer story as time goes by.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting because the timing for me was kind of fun because Amazon had announced SNS like the day before.
Right.
And they were really excited about the fact that they'd stood up this, again, idiosyncratic, not open service. They're like, ha ha ha, we can send emails now. And like I knew it was coming out the next day and I was just sort of biding my time. And then the next day, I think, not to, carry the torch too much for my paycheck, but we came out with something that was broadly deployable in different ways, more of a platform, something that we can make cloud ready for people to use how they want in a more open way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're different approaches,
mm-hmm.
but it was interesting timing there for sure.
Yeah, I think, certainly it seems that there are people who want to buy into the, I'm picking Amazon as my provider and I want to go with that full suite of solutions, and that probably works great for a lot of people. And then there are others who want to be more selective about the components and make sure that the components of the overall solution have a little bit more flexibility to work in a broader ecosystem.
I'd love to hear what Wes thinks about that, given that he deploys to that platform.
To which platform?
Amazon, just in terms of SNS and what you saw in terms of SNS versus maybe a Rabbit approach.
Well, I think that having something that is the not that you can pull from instead of polling is really valuable, being able to just push out information. I think that SNS is interesting in that regard. The problem that I have is one of my biggest complaints probably in working with a lot of different cloud providers is that I have to pull for so many different things. I would like it if instead of just offering as a service something like this, that I could actually just say, hey, I want to boot a server. Can you just let me know when that server is ready?
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to. Yeah. That would be the exciting part for me really is at the point that becomes integrated.
Without having to actively pull for it.
Right. I don't want to have to ask every 10 seconds, is my server ready now? Is my server ready now?
Right. I upload a video and they tell me when it's done.
Exactly.
Cloud events.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like a hard thing to do.
Well, it was surprising that wasn't a part of the announcement because it's an independent service otherwise. I mean, it does integrate with their SQS, but that was the first thing, I also looked at. It was, so EC2, which everybody has to have things out there polling for, was not integrated with this. I mean, I'm not sure exactly how that happened. But I think one of the things about these platforms versus technologies like, Redis and Rabbit are that, platforms are better sells when they either need to scale a lot or they're very difficult to configure. And Redis and Rabbit are not difficult to configure stories. They're the ones where you find blogs about, it takes me, 1 minute to get started with this. And if I can choose very targeted usages of some of the software, you're not really going to spend a lot of time on that, especially if you can bundle them inside the domain of your application. Not that managing, you know, a large network of exchanges is easy, but as far as the very simplistic things that you get out of some of the platforms, I don't think it's terribly difficult to stand those things up.
Mm-hmm. And I, as an observer of Amazon, I see it as two different businesses with Amazon. One is they've got this business of standing up hardware for you in a cheap, reliable way that a lot of people have taken use of. And there seems to be this other wing of them, which is building these software services.
Right. And you don't have to use them all together. I mean...
No, and I actually see, like, they want to be, like, the sexy software provider, right? They want to be prescriptive about how the entire internet should be doing SNS or something like that. But I think it's yet to be seen that the broadest adoption has been of their services versus their basic infrastructure.
Yeah, I think the general stereotype of their offerings is still much more focused on EC2 compared to the 6 to 10 services that they offer on top of EC2. But one can only guess, you know, how that mix might shake out over time. So we don't know. We'll have to watch.
We certainly don't know. I mean, because if you look at a year ago, I mean, their platform story has changed a lot. I mean, it hasn't been completely static. The only things that have been static are the ones like, you know, S3, but even that recently has had a lot of movement, you know, relatively speaking, with adding of version control and such like that. And so I think that you're right, you know, EC2 may be the core, but they're really surrounding it and making it, you know, if you buy into all these services like Waysco has with their latest grid architecture, then you're really going to be on Amazon for a long time.
Yeah, and the one last thing I'd add around this Rabbit conversation to come back to Rabbit is we had an interesting ISV, which I won't disclose, kind of come in this very room, and we were talking about loosely coupled architectures, very message-based applications, and we were like, oh, do you love the cloud? And very frankly, they said, we can't stand Amazon because the network problems that we're running into in a message-based application it's not working. And I think that's one of their strategic problems, potentially long-term, and they might fix it, is network performance in a highly message-based application space. Because I've gotten some feedback from people that said it's not fast enough for them today.
There's no doubt that there are definitely people for whom the cloud isn't the perfect solution as it currently stands.
Let's not say the cloud.
Let's say this
for EC2.
For EC2 offering. Okay, so I stand corrected. Yes, yes, yes. So there's a whole variety of clouds, but using the term loosely, for a lot of companies, a public cloud solution just doesn't cut the mustard yet.
A completely commodity, lowest cost node, oversubscribed network, bad I.O. cloud.
Right. Now that leads indirectly to our next item, which I believe I found this one through data center knowledge, that Twitter is now going to build their own data center. So that begs the question, obviously they, you know, are doing this by choice and maybe they looked around and see if they could have a public cloud solution, but it wasn't able to meet their needs. So I think Twitter has also probably reached a stage where they see themselves competing directly via with Facebook and Google. And in that game, you have to have your own data center and the complete integration from soup to nuts in order to deliver what you have to deliver. What does this mean for the cloud? Will they get there? Will these big services be able to be on a public cloud, or are they always going to have to do it themselves?
That Amazon's particular cloud was awful for message-based systems.
That was the point.
I would probably classify Twitter as having a large message.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing the operations lead from Twitter last year at the Velocity conference say that they looked at these cloud architectures that just didn't fit the resource needs that they had. You know, they like to measure down to the bare metal. They like to be very cognizant of memory utilization, of CPU utilization, and having too many layers in between just wasn't going to cut it. So at the time, they were using, I believe, NTT America to deploy servers for them, and then basically after the racking and stacking was done, they'll get an IP address and they're on their way. But Adrian West, what do you guys think about Twitter building their own data center?
The number of applications that are like Twitter or going to become like Twitter are so small that I'm not sure that Twitter going off on their own to do this really indicates much of anything. I mean, like, as you were saying, there are some really large companies, Twitter or Google, for instance, that are just at some point going to just have to do this, basically. I'm not sure that it speaks that much to the space as a whole, really, at all.
Yeah, they're certainly on one edge of the spectrum. This is not representative, I think, of the mainstream market. But it is, I think it does point out the fact that, you know, you can't do everything that you want to do in a stereotypical public cloud computing solution, that there's still room for stuff in between.
Well, I mean, it maybe not the best analogy, but I mean, you can't do everything in a Civic either. And if that's the only car choice, you know, you may decide I'm going to build my own car. But the thing is that there's plenty of choices out there. They're just not all fronted with a cloud API.
Yeah.
And so you do have you know, HPC hosters and, you know, big strong 10 gigi networks in between devices. But the thing is that I guess it's the question of if you build it, they will come. You know, or are you going to wait for customer demand? And is that customer demand in the meantime just going to go ahead and build their own?
Yeah. I mean, there's this ongoing debate that I see a lot between, you know, new applications can take advantage of things and architect knowing what's possible and not possible in public cloud infrastructure.
And the great example then is somebody who's going to push, I guarantee you, more bits than Twitter, as popular as Twitter is, how many messages they have, which is Netflix, mm-hmm. which I thought huge news, said we're going all cloud.
Right, and Amazon, for that matter, which they sort of compete with, which is a little bit ironic.
Thanks for mentioning that, Gary.
But yeah.
but, I mean, if you look at how many bits streaming a video to every person in America is going to take, that's going to be a lot more just raw resource intensive. It's just that every user can kind of have their own little stream with not a lot of server-to-server traffic and some of the other things that, you know, a Twitter might have to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Twitter's a unique application, I think.
And they've been cloud haters. Adrian and I had drinks with some of their DBAs one night, and they just they're cloud haters, and they're kind of high-attitude people over at Twitter, so...
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe they have to be for their application, right? We don't know, you know, what they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
That's true.
They've been maxed out, right? Like, their app has been at the edge of dying.
Right. So, go ahead, Wes.
I think that a big part of this actually does come back to kind of what was being hinted at there in terms of, like, Netflix versus Twitter. I think that another part of this is that in a lot of ways, Twitter was not necessarily designed for the cloud or even with that in mind at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, it's sort of like bound to fall down when you try to move it onto that sort of infrastructure where the expectations and the restrictions are much different than they are in a standard hosted environment. Like, potentially, maybe, like, if they would have, you know, architected it drastically differently, maybe it would work perfectly fine with the requirements that actually are provided there.
Right.
So maybe it is just a matter, maybe it isn't a cloud problem, maybe it's a developer problem.
Well, that's what I think is interesting, right? That people who are starting today and have a really good idea of what's available in public cloud infrastructure can begin with that understanding and those assumptions and design applications that are tolerant of network latency, are tolerant of instances coming up or going away at a moment's notice.
And don't forget that Twitter started in the cloud. They started on Joyent.
Mm-hmm.
They started on Joyent on Solaris. I was at Sun at the time. And their app didn't perform, but they blamed Joyent. And we spent a lot of time with Dtrace and some other things trying to debug why that was happening. It turns out it was their app. So they started in the cloud, had a bad experience. So I'm sure that underlines and permeates some of their culture.
Right. Great. Well, moving on, a couple of product launches, company launches that happened last couple of weeks. One was Datamere. They're doing an interesting solution with Hadoop Analytics. My understanding is that they're presenting a very simplified, web-based, Excel-like interface to then tap into a variety of data sets that could be available in any different kind of location and aggregate those together. But sort of a twist on BI without asking people to relearn BI tools and using the simple expressions of Excel or spreadsheet-like infrastructure that just about every person in the business world understands. So we'll keep an eye on that. And then the other launch that we saw was a new 10 gigabit Ethernet switch from Arista and got a lot of attention, more ports, less power, smaller footprint. And I'm a big fan of just more of a focus on network infrastructure for cloud computing as a whole. I think that in general, the industry tends to believe that all these servers just sort of like magically coalesce together in a data center through, you know, wireless or something. And that having the network infrastructure really is critical. And James, you've been following the networking world and pay a lot of attention to that. What did you follow the announcement and any particular thoughts there?
I did. Hats off to Doug and team for just an awesome product launch. And in fact, the same ISV that was talking to us about message-based applications in the cloud was already partnering with Arista and going to Arista as their number one core architecture for what they were trying to do, because Arista is focused on, let's not have this huge legacy of, you know, configurability and features that maybe a Cisco IOS has. Mm-hmm. Let's just provide a highly configurable and screaming core network switch.
Yeah. I mean, have the requirements changed for the network with the modern cloud computing oriented data center? I mean, is it different?
Well, I mean, one thing you find is that, especially with reverting back to the image idea, which, you know, 10 years ago people were making images, and now all of a sudden images are being used in the cloud. That's pushing around lots and lots of data to boot up servers that are supposed to be ephemeral, do short-term amounts of work. You have, high-throughput applications that are doing things like MapReduce and then coalescing results. Essentially a network brain, which would definitely benefit from higher bandwidth in between. I think that it is more the tools that people are using right now and some of the approaches that are baked into what people's idea of the cloud is, especially like image-based concepts of deployment.
You're saying like virtual server images that are being spawned and loaded and downloaded and then closed and moved around.
I was watching on the DevOps toolchain recently. This is a mailing list that a lot of folks that are involved in that industry chat about. And this one was about the question about having like an embryo image that you stack Puppet on and stuff like that versus stamping images for all your releases. And it seems to be that there's a population of folks who release more than 100 machines. They might use Puppet or Chef to produce an image, stamp it out, and then push it for every even minor release of their project. And as these images themselves could be, you know, several gigabytes or larger and pushed out to hundreds of nodes at the same time, you can imagine the impact of any substantial delay in being able to either cut over a new release or bring one back. And, you know, so that particular practice of, you know, re-imaging versus, refreshing your configuration has a huge impact, at least for these bursting times where people are doing software rollouts.
For the bandwidth and the networking requirements. Yeah.
So as a cloud user, let's ask Wes, I mean, do you ever run into network bottlenecks with what you guys are doing?
At times. I mean, we don't see that many times where necessarily like someone's application is having that many problems, but like we have a lot of problems just in terms of like latency between our app and the cloud itself, I think, more so. And maybe it's just that it may just be selection bias that maybe I'm just more aware of the problems that we in particular run into more than our customers because that's what I deal with on a day-to-day basis. But I mean, there are a lot of times where we'll have issues, you know, like just like we'll need to SSH into a box so that we can tell it to do something. And we just won't get good connectivity. Like, we'll have times where, you know, there will be hours where just we can't get good SSH connectivity. And it's
right.
Like, you know, our deploys are halted.
But that's more of an internet connectivity thing, perhaps, than a inside the data center LAN-like connectivity.
Well, but I think it's in the EC2 side where that would be happening. I could be wrong, but I think Adrian makes a good point. But I also think that latency and like just dropping packets, so that there might be decent bandwidth, but you know, latency performance is also also important. I see latency as maybe a bigger issue. It's like they'll get the packets through,
right?
But they're going to have to schedule them when there's breaks.
But isn't that the sort of core premise of the cloud? Is that you're doing over subscription, which is how you get the economic squeeze the economic juice out of it as a provider, and therefore you have to sacrifice something in that equation, and latency seems to be the thing that gets sacrificed first.
You have to look at also not just the network, but the performance. This is again mentioned by this ISV that came in, of the hypervisor itself in terms of passing that bandwidth that the raw physical connection is giving it into the guest. In fact, NASA Nebula, Josh was giving a speech, and to quote him directly, he said, "We were putting a 10 gig connection to the Zen hypervisor. The most we were able to get in there to a guest was 1 gig.
So that's there's some networking efficiency at the hypervisor that maybe has room for improvement.
Yes, because I mean, Amazon could go out tomorrow and buy a bunch of big Arista if they needed to, right? If it was just a raw bandwidth issue. But I think it's overall it's their architecture, and you know, if the people say it's a complete commodity in terms of what you do in the virtualization layer.
There's an interesting write-up from Torsten over at Rightscale some time back about the load balancing and like HA proxy versus the Elastic Load Balancer. And I believe it was at the end of the day just the network packet bandwidth out to the instances themselves that was a limiting factor. And it really didn't matter so much whether it was one software product or another, because it was just how many packets you could actually get through that TCP stack. Mm-hmm. And to me, it didn't seem like high enough, because they were talking somewhere in the tens of thousands, that just wasn't that much, that it seemed like it could have been a physical problem.
Yeah. Great. Well, let's move into some of the roundtable topics that we slated for today's conversation. One that I wanted to begin with was, James, you mentioned a couple of weeks ago that you were spending a ton of time exploring enterprise cloud adoption scenarios. So give us a little input there. Maybe pick your top two or three after your exhaustive explorative study, and tell us, you know, what are the primary adoption scenarios that enterprises are looking at, and you know, what are they thinking about?
So I can't give away everything I'm working on, but you know, I care for what you tweet. Apparently, I think the color I would give here is that an enterprise might not come in as just one person trying one server. In you know, at one moment, they're really looking. The smart enterprises that I see, and you can see a company like NuScale, Rodrigo, who's another Cloud Club friend, does. They really want to start to link up clouds and provisioning. So a lot of these internal enterprises have, sorry, procurement provisioning, right? They want to say, oh, I need to procure XYZ. Like the other day, we're building out a lab to test some stuff, and we got online and we procured, you know, X number of physical machines. And they want to start to link up some of the cloud and make it transparent that this is actually being deployed to the cloud. So I think that's one that I would look at, which is to get from the single user scenario to the vastly multi-user scenario for a cloud is going to be very important. And you know, in terms of how some clouds do identity management, user access control, today you're dependent upon a third-party ISV like an Instratus or somebody else to give you user rights and role bases. So that's something that I'm very much paying attention to. And if you look in the vCloud API, one thing that you'll first thing you'll see is it's got different roles.
Right. So that's interesting. I mean, yeah, we people talk about that the cloud computing often gets started by a creative developer inside a company who starts doing something on their own and then convinces two or three people to use it, and then that expands and that expands. But the conventional model for enterprise procurement is not a unit of one. It's a department or a group. And now you start to deal with a whole variety of needs and requirements and use cases. It gets very complicated because everybody's putting their hand up saying, I want X, I want Y, I want Z. And it's hard to channel all of that into a single source solution. So are there tools or are there things that are developing to help people with that?
That's the part I wish I could talk about, and I can't yet.
Were you going to say something, Andrew?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, people, you know, have creative solutions to using the tools that are available to them in order to get their jobs done. So, for example, I know Wesley and I were talking earlier today about, you know, the various ways people are using Amazon accounts to establish various, you know, mechanisms of control. And if you think about, you know, a lot of software engineers, especially recently, with doing things like you know, blob stores as opposed to highly structured data, they're able to handle a lot, you know, a lot of responsibility to mold very, very basic primitives into components or control structures or applications that they need them to be. And so I don't necessarily think that having a one API that fits these needs is A, possible for all contexts, and B, really going to hold people back that are motivated. Because if I'm a motivated user, I'm going to, you know, combine what's out there with what isn't to get my job done.
Right, and as long as you can use your credit card, right, then it doesn't really matter.
That's a absolutely stunningly great point from Adrian about tying that back to blob stores and S3, though, right, which is highly unstructured, doesn't give you a lot of extra tools, and yet people, you put a meta layer on top of that to make it what they need it to be. I think the other question, though, is can we get the dumb users? I mean, the truth of the market, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but can we get the people who are not highly motivated? Can we get people for whom this is a brain-dead simple thing to do?
Right. And that's not the case yet. I mean, the most common, you know, cloud solution out there is still developer-focused, not end-user-focused, or not general business person-focused yet.
Well, there's some of that. I guess there's WaveMaker, there's Blank Slate. There are a couple other products out there that are kind of like using cloud-like or actually running in the cloud resources to do some very simple operations. But I think that the you know, with the announcement you had mentioned with Datamere, I think that there are at least a few niche players that are that are trying to work and make some deployment things easier for folks that aren't necessarily sophisticated users.
Right. So here's my question. I mean, are we going to see some products or services from cloud providers or from third parties that are going to channel or act as the channel between a large enterprise and six or seven different cloud use cases that they have and the public cloud that's being consumed, right? I mean, the model for enterprise, they don't necessarily want 100 different touch points in their procurement food chain. They want to be able to create some kind of harness and then say, okay, well, within this harness, you have access to services A, B, C, and D. You know, but then back to your point, Adrian, is that just a false pretense that people are going to, you know, root around it anyway, which is sort of the classic cloud computing story, like some guy goes off and signs up for a thing on his own?
Yeah, I think it depends on the leverage of who's doing it. And so, I've come from various enterprises where you have departments, you know, choosing their own, like, you know, middleware stories that are different than the rest of the company, and the ones with the leverage can do it. And the ones that are, you know, in environments that aren't locked down particularly carefully, you know, credit cards can get you a lot, at least for doing ad hoc work, you know, dev test and sometimes production. So I think it depends on the enterprise, how much they see IT as a enabler versus a burden. And, you know, and I think the attitudes have a lot to do with it. And I think that's been one of the contentious points of the DevOps thing, where some people look at it as dev versus ops, and others feel it as an integrated approach.
For people who might not have heard about DevOps, can you give us a 1-minute overview of your understanding?
This is another one of those terms like cloud that people have different interpretations of. I feel DevOps is that job description people didn't have before, but there were people doing it. And what that means is the folks that are actually actively involved in engineering operations to the level of A, sophistication and B, testability of software. And so what you end up with that is you know, a mesh team where sometimes it's folks wearing different hats that they're going to be the ops person these certain days of the week, but they're also developers. But mainly, I look at it as an integration of development fundamentals of engineering into the operations process and less so of the throwing things over the wall.
Right. So historically, it was more there was the development team. They would finish something, throw it over the wall, and then the operations team would do deployment.
Yeah, and that's what makes a lot of jobs for operations people. And very, you know, in at least in my experience, that's been where there's a lot of churn in operations because there's not a lot of opportunities for empowerment to change things. There's rules and regulations, obviously, about separation of duties, which, you know, make it seem sensible to have these very strict lines. But that doesn't mean that development practices should exit the operation space. And so it shouldn't be, you know, a lot of patching and no feedback directly into products or even shared expertise. There's a lot of ways that you can model your organizations to facilitate, you know, a DevOps integration as opposed to making it what seems to be very simple of ops and dev in different you know, management chains, different lines of command, different marching orders. You know, it seems simple. It seems like it might even be efficient, but it really isn't because it creates a boundary that doesn't need to be there, and it creates an us versus them, and that, you know, inside your own organization. I think that there's been a lot of fallout from that over the years, and I think people now have a name they can put on it as a potential solution to that problem.
Does that become the rallying cry? Like,
yeah,
this is, we need to integrate.
Maybe, but the counterpoint is that it also starts a bit of a fight. And I've seen the counterproductive arguments around DevOps is when you throw the name in people's faces, because ops people go over my dead body, because for years they've dealt with the profligacy, I guess, of the developers to do whatever they want. But so I actually think it's much more, I mean, as valid as every point he made is, when this conversation comes up, I talk about the specific tools. Because DevOps is so new that it's not a holistic.
So give us a few things of specifics.
I'd rather, with Wesley in the room, I'd rather have him give a few specific tools that he might be much closer to.
Sure. One thing in terms of the enterprise adoption thing, that going back to the DevOps part of this, that maybe this is just my perspective, but I think one thing that's potentially dangerous while we still do have this strong segregation is that in a lot of ways, the tools and also even just the way that the clouds are set up is a lot more developer-friendly frequently than it necessarily is ops-friendly. Mm-hmm. And if you have this strong segregation, then like they're like, I don't know, like the ops guys don't want to cloud themselves out of a job, right?
Right.
Even though the dev guys might well want to cloud the ops guys out of a job. I mean, like you have this internal conflict.
Sure.
As long as there is separation.
So I would say quickly, that is so true what he says. The last couple customer briefings I've done in terms of looking at private cloud was me sort of doing a little hand holding and saying, here's how you can empower yourself with this backed end resource that you can be the controller of. It's not scary.
Right.
So I think that's a huge force, which is the sort of the developer liberation front that has been cloud needs to start addressing operators and saying there's room for you here too.
Right. Which I don't know that it necessarily has done yet, but that there's certainly room for that to happen. And perhaps to some extent, pulling ops a little bit more towards dev is tempting because then the problem's already solved. Like there's already developer tools. So if you ops guys can be a little bit more like developers, there are tools that you have available to you.
Give us an example. Or a couple.
Fog.
Yeah, well, one of the main projects that I work on is called Fog, and a lot of the idea behind it is to, like, you have the power to dig down into the, like, nitty-gritty of these different cloud providers, but you also have a nice abstraction across them. So, you know, the basics of, for instance, booting servers and shutting them down and that sort of thing is almost exactly the same across multiple providers. So,
and that's a very ops task, booting and starting and resetting servers.
It's an ops task
and
that you and configuring that you have put into a software framework that basically provides some consistency across different providers.
Right, in the hopes that to some extent that it is a less scary thing, that it's not that there's a bunch of the like a series of nebulous things that you might have to interact with, as opposed to sticking with the thing that you know that involves sticking things in a rack and pushing buttons. Like you know that, right? Like that's you are exactly where you're happy there, you know, fine. But by hopefully making it easier to understand and easier to move between these different clouds and see how different ones are doing things, the discrepancies between them, where the power lies, where the things to be wary of, I think that we can hopefully make it a lot less intimidating.
Right.
So that's one tool towards doing it. Another big tool that I've interacted with quite a bit is called Chef, which is
sure.
a tool for actually doing the configuration part of things. And so in a lot of ways, I think like Chef has already started to get more and more adoption, even in terms of like, you know, private clouds or even not even clouds, you know, just like for configuration.
Sure, people use it just inside a traditional data center.
Exactly. So like I think that in the same way, like I think that although configuration at this point has gotten a lot of attention in terms of making it easier, more, you know, like more abstract, you know, because, you know, one of the really nice things about Chef is in a lot of cases you can write a recipe that you don't have to write like an Ubuntu recipe and then like a Gentoo recipe. Like you write a recipe and you have your recipe and that's kind of
across multiple operating systems.
Yeah. I mean,
which scares
always
some
the case.
Ops people a little bit.
Right. So explain to me, I mean, I've followed the activity with Chef and Puppet, which is a similar sort of configuration management. What's the difference between those tools and Fog again? Just help me understand
so,
that again.
So the Chef and Puppet are both very much in the same space, which is I have a machine and I want to move it from being a blank slate to some that, you know, capabilities X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Fog, on the other hand, it stops before that point. Fog says, I don't have anything and I need a machine.
Okay.
So it focuses very much on the I need to boot a machine, it needs to have an IP, I need to have that IP tunneled through security groups or whatever, I need it to have this much data storage.
So that sounds like you said, when you have nothing and you need to start from scratch. So one of the tools that I hear about frequently is WriteScale. So what? Give me the difference, and so that listeners can understand a little bit between your Fog project and WriteScale.
Sure. So even coming into Fog in the first place, at the time there already existed a number of Ruby libraries that did, you know, arguably pretty similar things to Fog that had been published by WriteScale. So, for instance, Write AWS is a library for specifically interacting with the AWS services. It was Ruby. And at the time, in particular, there were some bugs in it. I didn't quite like the way that the interface was, that sort of thing. And it was open source seemingly in name alone. That's improved since then, but at the time, I mean, it was licensed open source, but it wasn't up on a site where it was easy to contribute to. Basically, like, if you had a patch, you could email it to them, and they might get around to
including it. Open source, but not open process.
Yeah, so that was a big turnoff for me. Like, cloud computing was something that I wanted to do more with. It was important to me, and so I wanted to have better tooling around it, and I felt that that wasn't necessarily the best tooling. Like, I felt like we could do better as a community in terms of providing open, uniform, you know, nice abstractions across these providers. And so I undertook to, you know, towards that goal, and Fog has been the result of that.
Gotcha. So one of the things I want to talk about was this common abstraction layer between premise and cloud, because one of the things I hear a lot about, and this gets back to some of the enterprise discussion as well as cloud discussion, is people say, hey, you know what, I have this data center, I like it, I'm not going to throw it out, but I love the idea of cloud computing, and I'd like to find a way to make the processes between these two areas more seamless. Tell us a little bit how Fog fits into that picture, you know, where that might help people.
Right. Well, I think to some extent, just making it easier to get started in the cloud is one of the biggest things that is really important. I mean, to some extent, I know even just when I was getting started implementing Fog in the first place, like, I almost didn't even know where to start.
You know? Right.
You're like, I just want a machine that I can SSH into, for instance. Like, that's not necessarily entirely trivial. Like, there's a lot of steps involved in just getting that machine up, getting an IP on it probably, and making sure that the security groups are set up and stuff like that. And then if you learn it once for one cloud, but then decide that maybe there, you know, once you get into that cloud, you realize that it has some limitation that's going to be unacceptable for your use case. So, oh, well, now you need to move to the next cloud, but now you have to learn all these discrepancies all over again in these little idiosyncrasies.
Right.
So the hope anyway is that one of the biggest and nicest things we can do is just lower that barrier to entry.
Right.
And then it's not such a big deal. Like, yes, you do have your data center that you like a lot, but you need more machines. So rather than becoming more invested in that, there, you know, there's a good breakpoint where you can just cross over.
Great. So, Adrian, JClouds has also got this idea of creating an abstraction layer to make things easier for people who want to do deployment and operations to multiple clouds. So give us a little bit of background there and, you know, some of the similarities and differences between what Wes has described with Fog.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in fact, there are a lot of similarities. And this is actually one of the reasons why I created this Cloud Hackers Collective, because there are many people who are taking different angles, and it might be a language angle, it might be an approach angle, but are actually dealing with very similar concerns. You know, and it happens to be a perspective that's being taken that you can empower. So, for example, if JClouds, the J stands for Java, you're not really going to find a lot of Rubyists that are going to want to use Java. Period. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
And Fog is a Ruby focused project. Yeah.
Exactly. So in cases like, and a similar thing for Python, if you have a Python user, they're not likely to switch languages in order to do something like this.
Are they just going to go to Google anyway?
Or come from Google, but as it turns out, there are a few different cloud abstractions that are in the ecosystem today. Fog and JClouds are a couple of them, and you know, and the Cloud Hackers group is something that we're all participating in order to make sure that we are aware of where one particular project figures out some revelation, we have a place to share that.
Mm-hmm.
without unnecessarily tying all the projects to some like super structured thing. It's really a collective.
Right.
But to answer your question, besides being in Java and what that brings to the table, you know, there are differences in the way that JClouds works. One of the things that it does is that it treats sets of nodes as a unit. So, for example, not all cloud supported, but we tend to think in clusters and not as individuals. So you might have a cluster of one, but it's always a cluster in JClouds storage abstraction. And one of the reasons why we took that is it's a fairly daring choice is because there's another API in the Java space called Design, which handles the single node abstraction pretty well. So we could take some chances.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, you know, we end up having a bias towards doing things in sets.
Right.
And so that takes some of the set complexity away from the user. So when they're going to change from having 10 servers to 12 with a specific configuration, some of that cooking is already there.
Gotcha. Now, I mean, both of these projects, though, as you describe them, are helping people deploy and adopt multiple cloud providers. So it's still a little bit different from my question that I wanted to dig into as a group earlier on, is what do we do for the enterprise who wants that same sequence for the local servers and the cloud servers? What is available for people there, or what's coming available for people who want that?
Well, I mean, one thing...
We're going to get to yours in a second.
So I mean, in the cloud hacker space, I can answer about that because we meet and this obviously comes up. So there's another, you know, another tool called Delta Cloud that actually has hypervisor support for Revlum. There's libcloud has support for VirtualBox. And you know, and there's actually a demand for Fusion support in some of these cloud APIs.
Right. So you're saying that some of these frameworks will tap into the hypervisor that's in the local data center, as well as provide a similar abstraction to a cloud-based virtual machine.
And really, it tends to be a programming exercise because once you have the abstractions right, it's just about where you're deploying it, where you're collecting IP addresses from. The thing is about the need. If you can already handle your internal data center, your problem is then to look at cloud and then try to apply those practices. So what happens is you might already have a set of, you know, shell scripts and ways to interact with Chef or whatever, and this is a new project. So they don't necessarily come at mutual exclusion.
Right.
But I've certainly gotten requests to support things like Fusion. But the problem with some of these hypervisors is that they don't all have nice APIs to interact
right.
with. And so that's why I think, like, you know, private cloud APIs that are coming out, things like, you know, Eucalyptus, vCloud, you've got AbbeyQuil, and OpenNebula, which act like a cloud and take the burden away from having to you know, deal with the hypervisor directly. You can treat it just like a cloud,
right.
And it's your own data center.
You know, Gary, we talked before about Amazon building these services on top, right? One of the great questions to that is, how the heck do you take that internal, right? Like, they pretty much...
Yeah, you don't right now.
Amazon is built from the startup to be incompatible with anything else.
Right.
I'm gonna just qualify that a little bit. And
hit me.
And, I mean, not that I'm the most prolific Amazon lover, but, you know, Eucalyptus has tried to do a little bit here.
Walrus,
they have some of the services modeled. And also, you know, there are players out there that are looking to, at least in the S3 space, provide implementations that you can run yourself or in the cloud better. So both there's two folks that are pretty savvy in the Java space that are doing this. For example, you have EH Cache, which is in a lot of Java applications.
But Adrian, are they doing that sponsored by Amazon? Or are they doing that because Amazon has made such a big market opportunity with their incompatibility that other people can step into that white space? I mean, I would agree with you that things are happening. But when you create an SNS, that there's no blueprint for how to do that internally then, or how to...
Oh, I mean, they're clearly responding to S3 being a de facto web service style interface to key value data. And you know, and basically what they're finding, though, is that, you know, as Amazon has put artificial bandwidth caps on these services, that you can actually stand up, like what GigaSpaces does, they can actually stand up, you know, versions of S3 and SimpleDB inside of Amazon and run it a lot faster because they're not constrained by those bandwidth caps that Amazon puts on the services.
Okay, this leads to another topic that I wanted to cover, which was kicked off by a blog post that Lou Moorman from Rackspace did on GigaOM a week or two ago. And he talked about, you know, where should the openness be, and that the Rackspace strategy appears to be creating a very portable stack, right? They're now supporting Drizzle, the sort of new fork of MySQL. They're becoming the main sponsor of Cassandra, one of the popular open source NoSQL solutions. And the question that I have for this group is, where should the openness lie? Is it the API that, as long as it's transparent and well documented, that's good enough? Is it the underlying tools, such as the database or the key value store, that should be similar from one place to the next? Is it just that you get down to a common virtual machine and that's what you're going to get as the common? What do you guys think?
I think there's more than one answer probably, but I think that at this point to say that, like, well, the article in particular seemed, as you said, to point towards the OpenStack being sort of the problem. Like, that's where the problem was. And from trying to interface with multiple clouds, I'm not convinced that the problem isn't the APIs. I mean, because it's great if you have a common stack, but if you can't figure out how to move it from one cloud to another, because provisioning servers and getting them all set up and running is drastically different, I'm not sure what having this stack that you could theoretically move really gains you.
Right. If there's an API on top of it that is different, so big deal if the underlying tool happens to be the same.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And I mean, at some point, I think that this the answer to this question is going to shift over time to being the stack, probably, as kind of we work out the kinks of how it is that you should interact with booting servers in the cloud. I don't think it's ever going to be a universal answer, but I think that as we gain more experience, it will be clearer what the, maybe not perfect things, but, you know, what's kind of de facto standards of how to do these things.
Right. I mean, we see these things down at the infrastructure level. I know this is the Cloud Computing Show, and we should maybe, you know, stay up there, but things like Pixie Boot, or things like, you know, IPMI, which the server vendors implement for management. I mean, these things are really well established, and as long as you sort of run to the spec, you're guaranteed more or less to have the ability to do these things no matter which piece of hardware you choose. That's sort of what we want to achieve in terms of the commonality of the API, no?
Well, I mean, first off, I mean, and James will be familiar with this sentiment of mine that I don't believe that clouds have to be virtualized. I mean, not. I mean,
he's a bare metal hugger.
Well, I am too, so that's all right.
I just call
him J Metal from now on.
I think it's a perfectly reasonable option. And I think that as you have bare metal offerings and they are increasing, and everyone knows that nobody's touching Amazon as far as, you know, market penetration on much. But there are a lot more services that are being offered for, you know, bare metal, and Pixie Boot is going to be a core service for that. I think that you really do have to look at your data center and the types of services that people are expecting now. You know, I think that you can draw your lines, and a lot of times you've drawn lines based on your options. It's like, okay, well, because I can't control traffic management, that's not in my schematic when I draw my composite application. And, well, hey, guess what? Now you can get virtualized, you know, appliances to do things like traffic management. I think that the most, if I were to have asks here, I wouldn't necessarily say that the APIs, the way they work, is more important than actually sharing some similar data models within them. So, like, for example, if something's asynchronous versus not, whatever, long poll, I don't really care too much about that. If, for example, and, you know, maybe this is not the solution, but you have, like, things like OVF for import-export, you have your data import-export, like big data import-export, how do you handle that in mass? I think when people have a solution out of the cloud, as easy as it is in the cloud, in some sort of portable format, then the API and how that's achieved doesn't matter so much. The reality is that none of them right now share that. And so
they don't share the format.
Yeah, they don't share
or the API.
Or the API. And
right.
So it's actually a big mess. And
right.
That's why it takes a lot of time for, you know, a lot of the cloud hackers to deal with these problems. But I think with some tooling, you're going to get that. Another way you can do is just that the resistance is so high, you find other projects that, like .cloud and the Cloudlets thing, which and Abiquo does this too, where they would just convert every image format there is. So, you know, you've got five different, you know, virtualization formats, and we'll accept OVF too, and you will just, you know, we'll do that because we've realized that people aren't doing this naturally.
Right. Right.
Well, the first thing I'd like to do here is take a step back and take a little hats off to Adrian and the Cloud Hackers for actually writing code and solving problems as they exist today. because there's been so many people who've talked about the future problem and coalescing APIs in the future and open this and open that.
Let's form a group. Maybe, an alliance.
Maybe write a manifesto and talk about it on Twitter. You know, I think that's the discussion of tomorrow, which inevitably remains a discussion of tomorrow. I mean, I think history usually proves that out, that we never quite see the future coming. And I guess the group that's solving the problems of now is there.
Right.
And I think they're doing interesting, good work. If someone really, really wants to control multiple clouds in Ruby or Java today, they're so much better off due to this work.
Yeah.
And I don't see people complaining about this who've already tried that. Like, these guys have a right to complain about it because they went out and had to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how many of the people that are actually talking about open standards have ever had to try to do a multi-cloud project and really have a list of what really bugged them. I think a lot of them are political grandstanding.
Yeah, and I think there is a lot of posturing by vendors in the industry community to make noise or throw hands up that will hopefully convince people that, you know, this is the way to go. I mean, just to say, you know, Rackspace is putting their hand up and saying, we think that these common data stores, Drizzle and Cassandra, are the way to go. Other people are going to say, we think common APIs are the way to go.
Is that kind of bullshit on their part, though? I mean, because to say, we think that the whole world should move to these two data stores, that we've hired some developers to work in that team. I mean, is that really just a marketing message, or... I mean, how you say this so well, Gary. How can they ignore the entire data center architecture that exists today and say the whole future is on these two?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a I mean, I think those projects are phenomenal projects. I've written about them in the past. I'm a big fan. But, you know, yeah, if you're coming out of an enterprise architecture, you're not going to a NoSQL store tomorrow. So, you know, you need something that's much more compatible with the way you've been doing business and the way you've been interacting with data for the last 20 years. So, well, I think there's a lot to be said there in terms of where should the commonality lie. So I'm sure there'll be a recurring theme. We're getting close to the hour, so I want to keep moving forward. But thanks, Adrian, and thanks, Wes, for your input there and certainly all the work that's going on. When's the next Cloud Hackers?
So we have one coming up next Thursday, and what we're actually talking about Cloud Data. So Engine Yard is hosting us. I think there are about 12 hackers that are going to be there, some from out of town. And we're basically going to have a stab at just chatting about some of the integration patterns that people have been used to, what they're using, people that are, you know, literally out there writing the software that people are using, and how that can impact the work that we do going forward. A couple of us have projects that deal, you know, with both compute and storage, like, for example, Fog and JClouds. But Cloud Hackers are also folks from, like, Hadoop and Cascading and some of the other, you know, data-oriented projects that have you know, news to share. And, you know, we're all pretty good at making tools. And with a little bit of time, you can kind of at least sort out what you would work on and what's important from what isn't. And so what we're doing with the Cloud Hackers is essentially we're doing, localized meetups to talk about topics and potentially an agenda for our hack sessions. And then our next hack session is going to be global, which is on the 3rd of May, and, well, 3rd and 4th, because the guys in Auckland are actually literally going to be in the 4th by the end of it.
Right.
But we're starting to roll around. I think we're going to start in India, and then we'll go to London, Paris, Montreal, Atlanta.
Follow the Sun, Cloud Hackers. And where can people go?
Follow the Hackers.
Follow the Hackers. And what's the website for Cloud Hackers?
Well, right now, you can just go to the meetup. And if you look, Cloud Hackers SF, we have a domain.
The cloud.
Yeah.
A cloud service to make it.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. We're actually, none of us are great designers of websites. We're all the ones on the back end. And so we do have cloudhackers.org, but we haven't actually gotten around to that yet. We do have a logo. We have
good.
A cool logo.
Okay, well, that's where it starts.
And that's where it starts.
Great. A little roundup of some other shows that were taking place this past week or two. Of course, we had the MySQL conference that was here in Santa Clara, the Under the Radar conference, which had a number of cool startups there. They branded that one Commercializing the Cloud. We have the Big Data Workshop. We have NetWorld Interop coming up in Vegas, and James is going to be there, so if anybody wants to meet up with him, give him a shout. And then upcoming in the next couple of months, we have GlueCon in May, in the Denver area. Did you mention, Adrian, you're going to be there?
Yep, I'm going to be showing off some of the work Jake Clouds is doing in the Clojure language space. I'm also actually going to be at Interop next week, too.
Okay, great, yeah. Great. And then in June, we've got the dueling web infrastructure conferences, Velocity and Structure, back-to-back, so big week in the end of June before the 4th of July hits, and we're off to our cloud vacations. Last section of the show, Cloud Tips, where we give favorite companies, products, services for things going on, and I'll start off. So I always do the consumer-focused ones, as sort of a fun part of the Cloud Computing Show where we can sort of span the infrastructure to the consumer side. One of the things that I came across recently was an online service. I believe it's pronounced Kakoo, C-A-C-O-O, and this is an online diagramming tool where you can create really simple diagrams. You can essentially create stacked diagrams, basically add new tabs to your diagram. Each tab is an individual page. You can then take that entire sequence of diagrams and create an embeddable widget to put onto your website. People who see the diagrams could essentially download or go to Kakoo and be able to change and edit those and morph them on the fly for their particular use. It also has a really neat feature to just export as a PNG if you want to pop it into a presentation. And as I try to move away from desktop apps, one of the areas where I have not been able to move away is in just basic PowerPoint diagrams, PowerPoint Keynote, what have you. Google did launch Drawings not too long ago, but Kakoo is light years ahead. So if anybody's interested in, I've been using it for network diagrams. You can do flowcharts. You can do website mockups if you need to mock up the cloudhackers.org site.
Yeah, I might use it.
And, and very easy to share. Of course, the new theme, the sharing is more important than the number of fonts than you can choose for a particular application. So that is my recommendation for Cloud Tip this week. We'll have the link in the show notes. Adrian.
Sure. Well, one of the guys I've spoken to recently is Terry from Prospexis, and they have a cloud data governance product that has plugins for things like Salesforce. And what they really let you do is choose where and when your data flows in or out of your network, and making it possible to follow regulations and still use very user-friendly tools and where your users don't even realize that they might be using some fancy reverse proxy thing.
Hmm.
I thought it was not just a product, but just the insight and the in the weeds knowledge that Terry had about how data governance works cross borders and all that. I gotta put my hat off for that guy. And I'm keeping an eye out on Prospexis.
Give us the spelling of that.
It's Prospexis.
S-Y-S.
Yep.
Great. Who's next? Wes.
I don't know. Maybe it's a bit hypocritical considering that I was being down on some of the Amazon services with these guys, but...
Oh, balance it out. Balance it out.
Yeah, I'm kind of... One thing that I am sort of interested in is for instance, Couch.io, mm-hmm. which is basically the guys who put together CouchDB... have like a consultancy. This is not surprising. This is common in open source, but
sure.
One of the things that they're providing now is hosted couch, right? Which to some extent that is interesting to me, at least in part because I have messed with couch some. Like it's not always the easiest to configure. If I wanted to like have a replicated couch setup, like, you know, maybe this speaks to my more being more of a dev than an ops, but I would probably defer to the guys who wrote it. Like, that's very tempting to me to defer to those guys.
Right.
And to some extent...
So you're saying instead of deploying it yourself, like, the fact that you can just dial up the hosted service is right up your alley.
Well, it sort of depends, too. I think that there's certainly a class of developers to which things like SNS or, SQS or Couch.io really are very tempting because they don't want to have to deal with all of these little nitty-gritty things. They just want to say... Yeah, I'm perfectly willing to pay a little bit extra and have less flexibility, but not have to worry about it.
Right.
And so...
People like simple.
Exactly. So to me, I think a lot of services that are starting to pop up more, like Couch.io, for instance, in the CouchDB space, are very interesting. Like, I would, for instance, like, I might want to play with Couch over a weekend and see what it's like. If I'm in that situation, I would much rather have a service that I can go to and pay... hourly to have a CouchDB server for 48 hours and try it out than to have to worry about all of the configuration up front.
Great, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Thanks very much, Wes. James.
So last night I was at a meetup, the Yahoo Hadoop Users Group meetup, which hats off to them for running a really quality show. I swear there's more than 200 people easy there. So,
wow.
And I go to a fair number of cloud meetups, and that's impressive.
Yeah.
That's true.
One of the companies that was there, in addition to Facebook and Yahoo presenting their current Hadoop clusters and what they're doing with that, fun fact there that blew my mind continuously today was 12 terabytes of metadata a day from Facebook that they're now trying to do daily queries on in almost real time for their advertisers. So all those likes that you're doing every day are throwing off 12
terabytes
of dust. Wow. There was a company there called Bixo Labs, B-I-X-O, and they are doing a project called the Public Terabyte Dataset. And they're trying to create an index of the entire public web and make it a publicly accessible image and data source on S3.
Neat.
So they're trying to index most of the web and allow you to data mine against that. So it's pretty cool, and take a look at what they're doing.
Great. Well, that's a wrap up for today's show. Thanks very much to our listeners. And we'll just do a quick round of where people can find out more from you. You can Twitter address, and you guys be sure to give out the projects. We'll start with James.
@Waters with two T's, James.
Wes?
@Gemus, G-E-E-M-U-S. And all of my projects are hosted on GitHub, so if you just find the Gemus user, it's all right there.
Great.
Yep. @JClouds with an S. Also for the Cloud Hackers, it's @CloudHackers with an S. And both of those are also on GitHub.
Great. And for me, Gary Ornstein, @GaryOrnstein, O-R-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. And that's a wrap. Thanks very much to everyone for listening to the Cloud Computing Show. You can visit us at thecloudcomputingshow.com or email us at thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. Feel free to subscribe on iTunes. You can do a quick search in the iTunes podcast library for The Cloud Computing Show. It should come up right there. And we look forward to seeing you on the next show. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.